Today is Wednesday, February 26th. We're in our traditional format of an informational meeting with invited testimony only. We will first call to the dais Ian Timms and Craig Hostetler. We are going to hear some very important testimony regarding SafetyNet clinics. And let me give you guys and the witnesses to follow, you know, basic perspective. Rick's probably done this, of what the committee's trying to do. I mean, we're looking at the pieces of, you know, the Oregon healthcare delivery system. I mean, from the commercial side, the public side, SafetyNet side. We're not so much interested in what OMAP per se does. I mean, we'll get there, but the first thing we want to do is get the big pieces and then hone the edges, put them together, and create the best jigsaw puzzle we can. So anyway, that's what we're doing, and we appreciate you guys being here. Enter and sign in, please. But first of all, turn that mic around and get them real close to you. Those wires come out of the desk there if they're not close enough. You got lots of flexibility. And I will have to excuse myself as you guys do, so I'll turn this over to my able vice chair, Representative March, and I'll be back as soon as the speaker lets me.
Okay. Chairman Westland, members of the committee, my name is Ian Timm. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Primary Care Association. And due to circumstances a bit beyond my control, I am resigning my position at the end of next month after almost 15 years with the Primary Care Association to take care of my mother, who now has cancer, which is metastasized. But I have brought with me Craig Hostetler, who is the acting director of Oregon Primary Care Association and has been learning the ropes for the past 2 years and providing direct management assistance to the community health centers. And he's the one who's going to make the presentation today, respond to questions, and will be the ongoing continuity for continuing questions, deliberations that you might have regarding the safety net in Oregon and Oregon Primary Care Association. So thank you very much, and I apologize for having to put my mom as a priority, but she took care of me when I couldn't take care of myself, and that's a debt I can't repay, but I intend to help pay it down a bit.
Thank you, Mr. Timm, and the best to you and your family.
Okay. Thank you, Vice Chair March and members of the committee. Again, I'm Craig Hostetler from the Oregon Primary Care Association, and I wanted to talk a little bit about who we are, and actually, in the meantime, introduce Jackie Mercer, who is with an organization in Portland that focuses on Native American patients. They deliver some mental health services and health services, and she'll talk more about that later. And also we have Paul Logan to my right, who is a federally funded community health center, who will talk about his services that they deliver. The Oregon Primary Care Association is a nonprofit membership association representing community health clinics. And we're starting to substitute the word community health clinics for safety net clinics, because safety net sometimes draws up some things about practices that aren't as high quality as our community health clinics have, even though they serve everybody regardless of ability to pay. I'll get into that a little bit later. So just a note that that's what we're talking about these days. The community health clinics, which are our main members and our primary member, are federally funded community health centers, which are also called federally qualified health centers that receive federal funding. And basically, the simple definition of a basic safety net clinic or a community health clinic is a clinic that serves everybody regardless of ability to pay, and they're accessible to vulnerable Oregonians. So if you're locked behind a gated community and you're serving everybody, you're not really a safety net clinic unless there's vulnerable Oregonians there. And the caveat to that is some community health clinics are in frontier and rural areas. You may have heard of them as rural health clinics, and if they leave town, then there's nobody in that area. So we consider those safety net clinics or community health clinics as well. So I'm going to briefly touch on the different types of clinics and then go into some of the other testimony. But there's five different types of clinics that we consider community health clinics or safety net clinics. And those types are community-sponsored clinics, which primarily fundraise from the private sector to serve uninsured patients. There's some other things that are in the testimony, but I won't go over all of them. The federally qualified health centers use federal dollars to serve uninsured patients, and there's no match required for those federal dollars, so it's straight from the federal government. Indian health clinics serve Native Americans, and tribal clinics receive Indian health service rates for patients, and there's no state match required for those rates as well. Jack will talk a little bit more about how her clinic fits into that scheme, but is not a tribal clinic. Rural health clinics often, again, are the only clinic in town, so if they leave, then there's basically no access to primary care in the area. And school-based health centers target children, but also they branch out and target adults of children as well as community members around the school. So which one is the best clinic for a community? That's a question that comes up all the time, and my answer is it depends. It really depends on what the community decides that they need. It depends on how the model can fit to their unique needs. And so we support all types of these health clinics. What I'm going to talk a little bit more about is the federally funded community health centers, because that's what I know the most about. That's our primary member. That's the technical assistance I provide. And for the federally funded health centers in Oregon, our patient mix, the primary members are, primary patients are 40 to 50% uninsured, 35 to 40% Medicaid, so that's the majority of our caseload. And as patients lose coverage under OHP, they fall off of OHP and become uninsured, but they stay in our clinics because we're committed to serving both of those populations. So they get continuous care, so hopefully their health status doesn't fall off once they fall off of OHP. So community health centers by mission and by federal mandate have to be located in medically underserved areas. They're committed to serving all people regardless of their health insurance status and ability to pay. And they're also locally controlled by a board of directors. And the thing that sets them apart from other clinics is the majority of the board are patients of the clinic. So we have uninsured Medicaid patients.
Mr. Workobian.
Yeah, thank you, Jared. Could you, Craig, kind of define medically underserved area, what that means in terms of generally when we have that definition?
Right. I'll give you the basics. The nuances of it gets a little bit complicated because there's different designations. But basically it means that the clinic is located in an area that's designated medically underserved by the federal government. Our state pulls together an application, looks at things like infant mortality, looks at things like the number of physicians in the area serving the patients. It looks at, you know, low income, a bunch of different indicators, which I'm not thoroughly versed on, but that's kind of the gist of it.
And maybe a follow-up on this issue. You're serving the underinsured or uninsured populations. What do you do in the case of someone needing a prescription? Do you have do you have a pharmacy to be able to provide drugs for those folks?
It varies. Two of our health centers, federally funded health centers, have pharmacies so they can spend. Others have pharmaceuticals on site that are free from pharmaceutical companies or from wherever else they get them, and they dispense them accordingly to patient need. We find our clinics having to put together a variety of applications to get these pharmaceuticals out to their patients, and it doesn't meet all the needs, but it meets some of it.
Chief, can I follow up on
that? Mr. Greenland, Representative Greenland.
Well, first, I want to welcome one of my constituents here. House District 33 is very proud of having Craig here to tell us. Picture. Craig, in your clinics that have the pharmacy services, you get is there a special price on pharmaceuticals that you get?
They're eligible for something that's called 340B pricing, or it's a federal pricing mechanism. which often is a lot lower than you could get on the private market. Sometimes if you get big enough purchasing pools together, you can drive the prices lower than that, but they do have access to that.
And why don't all of you have that so they can have access to those?
For that very reason, there's some purchasing pools that are driven through Minnesota. There's one up in Washington. There's one down in California. And sometimes they can get lower rates by going around it.
Thank you, sir.
Did you have it? Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had several questions. I want to define better what we're looking at in these clinics. I've always had difficulty getting a handle around it. Are all the clinics federally qualified or just some?
Just some of them. The first clinic, a community-sponsored clinic, doesn't have a federal designation or qualification. They're just a clinic that fundraises and meets the rules and regulations in terms of having appropriate provider licenses and things like that. So the federal government's not going to recognize them. The federal qualified health center, it goes through a very competitive process to become one of those. There's a lot of oversight looking at the quality of care, the administration, things like that.
Oh, Mr. Chair. Following on that question, federally qualified clinics have access to, I think, 340B plans, if you can set them up, and also we are required to pay Medicaid patients in those situations at cost, not at our discounted usual rate. Right. Knowing that, is it still something that we have not done because of the barriers to becoming a federally qualified clinic? Is it just a lot of hurdles to jump through?
There are a lot of hurdles. Let me restate your question to make sure I have it. You're saying that it's a cost-based system that we have in federally qualified health centers. So part of that cost base may be, distribution of pharmaceuticals and access of it. So how do we take full advantage of that? Is that it? There's a couple different reasons. I mean, all the safety nets clinics can't become federally qualified health centers for a number of reasons. There's that designation we talked about earlier. We're not designated across the state. There are a lot of rules and regulation and requirements which actually make for better business practice. I was on the private side of healthcare for a while, and I would have recommended a lot of these reviews that these clinics have to go through to make sure that the quality of care is appropriate. Going through the 340B process, there's some paperwork to go through that, but if there's purchasing pools that are out there that are very easy to join that can offer almost as big a discount, if not a bigger discount, then our clinics would go after that as well. So, did that answer your question?
Mr. Chair?
Hello.
Not really. The question is, why don't they all become federally qualified? I mean, it seems to me there's a lot of advantages to it.
Why don't they all become?
But is there too much paperwork to get through? Everything you tell me says they should all be federally qualified.
Well, there's a limited number of slots as well. Everything's competitive. So, like last year, we have a tremendous growth in federally qualified health center. The President of the United States is backing this and is looking at doubling the number of patients going through our health centers. Still, it's competitive. There were 130 new clinics funded last year across the country. Oregon did very well and got six of those funded here. So eventually, could we build them all up and get as much funding as we can? Potentially, but see, our health status indicators are a lot higher than other states. If you compare us to Mississippi and put our application against them, they're going to want to fund the highest need area and the one that's most ready to start a clinic. So there's a lot of competition that goes in there. So that's part of it. The other part is not all of our state is designated as medically underserved, so there's limited portions of the state that through that one designation alone, they don't qualify.
That leads to my next question, actually, is how many clinics are there across the state, and give me a feel for where they're located. Obviously, some of them are located in areas that are not designated by the feds as being underserved, but still are underserved, and you're dealing with populations there too.
Right. There's 18 federally qualified health centers. Two of them are located outside of the state, but have clinics in the state. And they're located. A lot of them are up and down the I-5 corridor. So there's this Multnomah County Health Department is a federally qualified health center. Clackamas Health Department is a federally qualified health center. We have one in Roseburg. We have one all the way down in Cape Junction and Grants Pass. And then we have some over in Ontario. The one in Idaho stretches across into Ontario. We have some on the coast, Tillamook, and Astoria was just funded last year. But there's a a book that I can give you that lists all the safety net clinics, including federally qualified health centers. It just needs to be updated for all the successes we had last year.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I suppose just to get this out of the way, considering how many clinics you have, we often will assess how a system is working by how many lives they serve.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how many lives you serve in the safety net clinics?
Basically, if you look at the federally qualified health centers alone.
Not just federally qualified, the entire system.
The entire safety net, okay. The last numbers that we ran, it's in this report as well, and we ran it by uninsured Medicaid because that's what folks were interested in. And basically, the safety net clinics or the community health clinics served about 17% of the Medicaid patients throughout the state, and this was based on 2,000 numbers. And it's been a while since I looked at it, but I think with uninsured, it was up around 27% of the uninsured.
In numbers?
How many lives are you insuring, so to speak, to use the phrase we use for other systems?
Right.
Not insuring any.
Let's see. Let me see if I got it.
I'm assuming most of the Medicaid folks are the fee-for-service folks. Would that be correct? No?
Not most of them. There's a lot of excess capacity that's out there that's not being served by the safety net. But if I were just to guess at the numbers, because I don't have the exact numbers in here, I would guess that if it's about 25% of the uninsured, then we're talking about 100,000 uninsured patients. If it's 17% of the Medicaid patients, then we're talking about a little less than 100,000 individuals.
So that would be those two numbers would add together then, so you're roughly 200, a little under.
Right, around there. And then there's some Medicare and private patients we serve. It's probably total to another 30,000.
Yeah, Mr. Rakobian?
I was just going to clarify that uninsured. I know what we have about a 12% uninsured adult rate in Oregon and 9% of kids. We're basing on that number there roughly then of 12. I think that's the correct number, about 12% uninsured in Oregon. You're serving 25% of those 12% that aren't insured of that whole.
You have some numbers there now.
Thank you, Ruby. They just handed me the part of the report that stated the numbers. Medicaid, 15%. This is based on 2,000 numbers. Went through our community health clinics, and that was 55,000 folks. And for the uninsured, it was 27% at 86,000.
Yeah, I want to be sure we're talking apples to apples. Is that visits or is that you?
That's people.
That's people. And they have multiple visits, probably.
Right. They have, on average, 3 to 4 visits.
So your total number was pretty big. It was
141.
It was 86,000 for uninsured, and that's people, and 55,000 for Medicaid.
Pretty impressive number. And you offer primary care, some prescription, but obviously no subspecialty care or hospital care. That's not something you can offer through your clinic.
No, but they're required to set up those relationships to become a federally qualified health center. Sometimes that stops the applications if you can't set up the relationships to refer.
Any other questions? All right. Please proceed.
Okay.
Thank you.
One thing that I wanted to get into, and that you started to tap into this, why aren't the federally qualified health centers expanded? We're going through that process now. One thing that I wanted to start with was good news. I know you haven't heard a lot of that down here lately. On the top of page 3, the good news is, as I touched on, the President of the United States and Congress on both sides of the aisle are supporting a substantial growth in health centers, federally qualified health centers, over the next 5 years. We're into year 2 of that. What that does is it enables you to leverage state and local money to the tune of, the obvious is, if we have 35% of our patients to 40% in Medicaid, you get a 40% state match to a 60% federal match for the Medicaid patients. But above and beyond that, about 25% of our budget for federally qualified health centers comes directly from the federal government to serve uninsured patients. And that's no match, and you can see that stretches the dollar further. So I listed the new access points, which are actually clinics in new areas there, and you can read that on the top of page 3. I also looked at expanded medical capacity grants that we got, which is substantially expanding our medical services in clinics that are already there. And then there's some dental service expansions and behavioral and one behavioral services expansion that we had in 2002. We're gearing up for 2003. It looks like we're going to have about that number again. My concern and what I put as the challenge is these new Bureau of Primary Health Care grant dollars are to serve new patients. It's not to supplant, if you have cuts in Medicaid or if you're losing money in other areas, it's not to supplant that money, but it's to take care of new patients. So, for example, if a federally qualified health center had 10,000 patients in 2001, in 2002 they wrote a grant, were successful to expand by 3,000 patients. At the end of that two-year period, they only expanded by 2,000 patients because they didn't have the budget to take care of all the uninsured. Then they would either lose part or all of that grant. So that's kind of what we're dealing with. That's in the statement. I just wanted to dispel the myth that the federal dollars would be able to supplant some of the cuts in Medicaid. The other thing that we've done is we've stayed on top of what the fiscal impact is of the OHP cuts, and I'll touch on it briefly because I know that's not the purpose of this. What we found is the cuts projected for 2003 outweigh the federal dollars that came in 2002. So we're going to lose a little capacity there that we're going to look at making up. On the page 4, the reasons to support the federally funded health centers, I just wanted to bullet point 5 of these. They provide comprehensive primary care services to vulnerable Oregonians. That's one thing that people support us for. The other thing is health centers are cost effective. I'll go a little bit more into that. They also provide a high quality of care. And we talked about bringing dollars to your local community, but we didn't talk about economic impact, and I have some information on that as well. And we already talked about that they're a good federal financial participation vehicle. On the cost-effective side, I'll just go straight to one number. In the back of your packets, you have the data behind it if you want to look through that. But the most impressive number that I found was for Medicaid patients in Oregon served by federally funded health centers. They show significant savings down line. So for Medicaid managed care organizations, they're saving about $60 per member per month for patients that are served by our health centers. And what I think that is that there's a lot of enabling services or transportation, interpreter services, things like that, culturally competency, that we spend a lot of our resources on, which I think saves money down line, and the Medicaid managed care organizations are realizing this. The second thing is quality of care. Our health centers, because the requirements are so stringent, is their quality of care is measured fairly heavily. Somebody comes in either every three or every 5 years, depending on how established a health center is, in what's called a primary care effectiveness review or a quality review, looking at auditing charts, taking a look at things like how is their management going? Is their board and governance structure appropriate? Is it going along smoothly, or is there changes that need to be made? And they can be defunded if they don't meet these things. The other thing that we've begun doing in the past several years is taking what's called a JACO survey, or the Joint Permit Commission of Accreditation, which hospitals go through and ambulatory care facilities go through. And our clinics have been passing this with flying colors, so we've been getting higher scores than the average. The last two points I wanted to bring up before Jackie and Paul talk about the specifics of their clinics are they bring dollars to your local community. We did a statewide economic impact analysis, so seeing what kind of employment, what kind of contracts, what kind of dollars are these clinics bringing into the community, because that's important. And there's an attachment that outlines this as well. But from the 10 health centers that participated in the study, and these health centers have a variety of clinics. They range from even having one clinic and up to 20 or more clinics. They basically bring in 1,763 jobs, either directly or indirectly through contracts, and they bring in $120 million in statewide output. The final thing that I just wanted to reemphasize is that it's a federal financial participation vehicle, which we're trying to make the best use of now that there's federal dollars, and our appropriation went up by $161 million The Congress just approved that, and so there'll be more dollars available this year. For next year, the President's already approved a $160 million increase to our federally qualified health centers, which is the largest increase that any president has ever made to the program.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Any questions for Paul before we go on to the next? All right, and could you, whoever's next, restate your name for the record? So, thank you.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jackie Mercer. I'm the executive director for the Native American Rehabilitation Association. I also serve as a commissioner for the Legislative Commission on Indian Services and am a member of the Governor's Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force. The needs for the Native American community are enormous and very complex. They involve physical, mental health, social, economic, and cultural aspects. Sort of a good example, I guess, of the complexity of things has to do with mental health needs for our community. And the report from the Surgeon General last year showed that for Native American youth 15 to 25 for males, that they were 50 times more likely to commit suicide than any other group in the country. And these numbers speak of epidemic problems, and yet there's not an epic kind of response. Our programs and services for Native people are extremely underfunded by the Indian Health Service. Native American Rehabilitation Association is a nonprofit Indian-owned operated organization. We have 95 staff. We have a $6.2 million budget. Well, that's before some of the cuts, but anyway, that's what we started with this year. And we have served in this last year 3,400 Oregonians. And we are situated in the Portland metropolitan area. We have, however, we have a contract for our organization to serve Native American people throughout the state for residential alcohol and drug treatment. And we are a regional treatment center for outpatient mental health and chemical dependency treatment at our programs. We operate a primary care clinic, which is our federally qualified health center. We have primary care services for Native American people primarily, although other people can come to other of our services. Our funding, again, is through the Indian Health Service for our health clinic, and that's a little unique from the other clinics. We're a Title V clinic. It's money specific for urban Indians. I've thought about getting a T-shirt that says Urban Indian and wearing it down here so that we could help people identify that there are urban Indians, which are Indians who live off reservation, which in Oregon is 40% of the Indian people in the state actually live off reservation, and the majority of those live in the Portland Tri-County area around there. So we have basically the statistics and the reasons that we serve. NAR has been in existence for 33 years. The diabetes rate for Native American people is 2.5 times the general population. Heart disease is 41% of the people who are 35 to 54 have heart disease. Sudden infant death syndrome is 2.6 times the general population. TB-related deaths are 533% higher than any population. I think that number in and of itself to me, while it's incredibly staggering, just speaks to the access problem for healthcare for people, that people can get so sick from something that's obviously very treatable in our society, but because of access issues around culture and around insurance, that becomes a problem. Suicide, as I said, is the leading cause of death for Native American youth 15 to 24, and again, 50 times more likely than for any other group or population. Fetal alcohol syndrome is 3 times more likely to affect Native children than any other group. The unemployment rate for Native American people is 2 to 3 times higher, and we have found that in Multnomah County, 50% of the Native American children live in poverty. 25.9% nationally, of Native American people live in poverty, two times any general population numbers. We have roughly, last year, as I said, we served about 3,400 Native American people. There are about 1,400 of those, I'm sorry, about 1,200 of those people were from Oregon tribes. The other people who are enrolled members of federally recognized tribes represent members of 257 different tribes, bands, and nations who live in Oregon. So it's a very complex culture and a very, you know, when people talk about cultural competence and cultural competence working with Native American people, I think often of the number of people who come to us with different customs and experiences and traditions and our responsibility to serve them. And our community is, you know, as diverse as any community from that perspective. We provided over 20,000 visits, I'm sorry, last year for the almost 3,400 people who came to us for treatment. For the health services part of our organization, we have about less than a third of our money comes from the Indian Health Service for treatment, and the other two-thirds comes from primarily from other insurances like Oregon Health Plan. We have been able to secure about a little bit over $1 million worth of funding in the last two, 3 years for a lot of health promotion activities. So we've taken the Indian Health Service money and we've really been able to use it as seed money to really develop and grow our program. We have a grant from the Center for Disease Control for Breast and Cervical Cancer Screening. We have a grant from the Office of Minority Health, federal grant for elders care outreach. We have a diabetes grant from the Indian Health Service to do some prevention work. And we have a tobacco grant from Legacy Health Foundation and also a small one still today from the state of Oregon for tobacco work. And our programs and services, we have currently four sites. We have integrated health care in all those sites, in our residential program, our outpatient chemical dependency program, and in our health clinic. And we have mental health, alcohol and drug treatment, health care, and culture all within each site. And we have probably 50 triage calls a day for folks that we can't see today in our health clinic with certainly our current capacity. With an Indian Health Service grant, we're not eligible for the pharmacy grant that Craig talked about, but we are eligible for pricing. At the moment, we have a contract with through Health and Human Services and get medications from Perry Point. And we also, we spent last year about $250,000 on medications. That's half of our Indian Health Service budget.
Perry Point is the drug distribution center.
It's the drug distribution center.
It was PHS.
That's correct. Sorry.
That's right.
And we also have used largely the patient indigent medication programs from pharmaceutical companies. Probably about $180,000 last year we were able to secure through that program for medications for our patients. We have, certainly at this juncture we're looking at some serious changes to our programs and services. As you all are aware, the loss of pharmacy benefit means that of the 1,800 adults who come to us, probably only 10% of those folks will be covered by health insurance, whereas right now about 50% of our patients are covered by health insurance. So we're really going to be for the pharmaceutical benefit, I'm sorry, with that change within the Oregon Health Plan. So it's a serious concern for us. And, you know, I think when you talk about safety net for the Native community, our Indian Health Clinic is really the safety net. As a lot of you all know and understand, for Indian people, the cultural differences, while people generally are bicultural, for issues really very personal and for trust reasons and because of all kinds of history with the federal government, people really choose to come to their own clinic. And, you know, we've had people who have fallen and broken their arm on a Friday night and didn't come, had health insurance, didn't go to the hospital, waited till Tuesday morning because it was a holiday weekend to come to us to make sure that he was going to get the right treatment when he went to the hospital. And, you know, we had another gentleman lately who had a heart attack on a Friday night and, you know, refused to go anywhere until he could come in to see our provider. These are issues about trust and respect and about safety. And you're talking about one of the most vulnerable populations in the state of Oregon. And the further we get away from the federal government in terms of the trust and the responsibility and the sort of the feeling of a commitment to serve people who are native people of this land, the harder it is to get help and resources. So, you know, in this time, you know, I just really ask you all to really consider how the changes impact our community, where we're already pretty devastated with tremendous amount of health disparities and very poor access. And alcohol and drug problems are, you know, relatively rampant, and their impact on children and families and adults is really very serious.
Thank you. Representative Greenlight.
Well, the question that I'm sure is obvious and everybody asks you all the time is, are the casino foundations helping you?
I'm glad you asked that question. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlight. I barely speak for myself. I guess I can't possibly consider myself able to speak for any tribe or other government. And, you know, what you basically see is on, like, Warm Springs Reservation, there's a 40% unemployment rate. You know, for tribes that have other kind of casinos, you know, their first obligation and responsibility has been shown to be for their elders, for their children, and housing and health care and in economic development to make up for hundreds of years of economic problems and poverty. So I know that each of the tribes, as they get successful, are developing their own foundations and are very successful in providing additional support back. But it's not, you know, it's not really their responsibility to take care of every Indian in Oregon, probably. Thank you.
Mr. Bacobian.
Thank you, Chair. Interested, we had a chance with a committee that met in a past interim to visit several Indian health clinics. And surprised the number of non-Native American folks in the community they serve. Is there, do you have some kind of numbers in terms of kind of the ratio or, you know, the tribe that serve non-Native, you know, community members who use the tribal clinics? Is there a restriction on how many people can actually use the clinic since it gets some, you know, dollars from the federal government for IHC? As, you know, could you explain that little relationship a little bit better, I guess?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The tribal clinics are each tribal clinic is very different. And as someone was speaking earlier, I think when Representative Bates was talking with Craig, tribal clinics are funded with 100% federal money. Our urban Indian program is not funded that same way. We have match just like every other clinic in the state. Because the money for NARA Indian Health Clinic is Indian Health Service money, we are restricted in treating somebody. The Indian Health Service audits our charts to make sure that we are seeing people who are enrolled members of tribes or descendants to descendants, which is the rule. Tribal health clinics have other funding sources and often are, you know, have contracts with other kinds of companies for services. We do provide health care for people who are in our residential treatment program, our adult program, and serve some non-Native people there. But for our health clinic, we are Native American clinic. And I guess, you know, we have, as Craig has talked a lot about, the Bush administration initiative for community funding for the 330 grants. We've been looking at that as an option for expansion for our program, and certainly that would change the criteria for treatment. So the numbers that I gave you were all people who are enrolled or two descendants from an enrolled member.
Thank you. All right, next up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Logan. I'm Executive Director with Northwest Human Services here in Salem. I'll tell you a little bit about our organization. Those have been around Salem for a while. We were known as the Cry of Love for many years, so that should tell you that we started back in the 70s during the hippie era. We now have a much more professional and hard-to-understand name as Northwest Human Services. We've gone totally business. Half of our operation is the West Salem Clinic, located on Kingwood and Edgewater in West Salem. That's where we have a medical clinic, which is a federally qualified health center. We have a mental health clinic, and we have a dental clinic at that site. The other half of our agency runs social service programs, primarily mental health. We have a homeless outreach and advocacy project, which targets homeless mentally ill adults. We have a connection program, which works with the deaf and hard of hearing. We have a host program, which is the only teen shelter for runaway and homeless youth between Eugene and Portland. And we want to run a crisis information hotline for five counties. Like I said, we've been around since 1970. At our medical clinic, we serve about 9,000 patients. And with all our services, we do about 60,000 patient visits a year. We're impacted in a couple different ways at the moment. We serve a little higher population of the Oregon Health Plan than some of the other safety net clinics. About 55% of our population is Oregon Health Plan. About 30% are uninsured, and the other 15% are Medicare and other payers. On our mental health side, about 45% or 50, no, that's not true, I'm sorry, about 80% or 90% of our population is Oregon Health Plan. We're the second biggest provider of mental health services next to Marion County itself, for Marion and Polk counties for mental health services. The impact, I guess, I got a note that said we should talk about what is the impact and what are we going to do about it. And I guess I'll just spend a couple minutes to tell you kind of how we've been trying to react or to be helpful to our patient population. First of all, before cuts came into play, we have been closed to new patients at our clinic since last October. That is just by virtue of the fact that we have only so much space and so many providers and so many appointments during the day. Last year, we did expand. We're one of the clinics who opened a new site in Monmouth and Independence, an underserved area. So we have a clinic, and that is the only clinic that is open to new patients at this point. We did that with some support from the Bureau of Primary Health Care, a grant, and that's a new start. We were looking until recently to do an expansion grant for expanded medical capacity, which would be at our primary site, and that's on hold at this point, just given the fact that we're not sure what our finances are going to be. The kinds of impacts we're seeing, obviously patients are real concerned, those who are losing their care. There certainly is a mad rush right now, which ends at the end of this week, for people to get in and get dental services because they're just done at the end of the month. And the kinds of cases we're seeing are people, literally a gentleman who called last week who needs to have 7 teeth removed and needs to have that done by Saturday. We're getting more calls from people who are looking to scramble to get into a new provider because they have had mental health services through the county or through another provider. Since the county is not going to get paid for those services, they're kicking all those patients back to their primary care providers, which are our doctors. Now, our doctors do obstetrics as well as primary care. They do not do psychiatry. And so one of the biggest issues that they're facing is they're getting letters from, for instance, Marion County saying, "Dear doctor, we're no longer providing mental health care for your patients. This is a list of medications that they're currently on. Please see that they continue to get these medications or some follow-up." I had a medical staff meeting yesterday morning, and it was reiterated again that primary care physicians and physician assistants and nurse practitioners don't practice psychiatry. So what we're trying to do is scramble to get psychiatric time to provide consults for these people, to provide medication evaluations, just to essentially give the doctors some kind of support. Now, secondarily, once you get past the issue of figuring out what medications people should be on is where they're going to get those medications. We have long been a user of the pharmacy assist programs we've always had a staff person designated, and we're soon moving to two staff people designated to do nothing but help patients get on the pharmacy assist programs. Mm-hmm. In my homeless outreach and advocacy project, we have about 30 very chronically mentally ill.
Dr. Greenlee.
That's really such an appalling story. Could we go back and spend just a little more time on that story? How many of your patients are currently served by the county, and how many are they handing back in terms of their ability to
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I can't give you hard numbers. What I do know is that we've been working hard with the county not to give patients back. My last understanding was there were about 175 patients that they were going to kick back to the primary, at least in the first draft, kick back to primary care clinics. We are a large recipient of those. We've been their primary care physicians for a good number, but I don't have an exact number of how many we received back.
That's somewhat appalling. We hear something like that in Multnomah County where virtually the same thing is happening. Are there not some requirements for those mental health providers to keep them in service?
Jackie, would you like that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenlink and committee members. We currently have gotten 30 referrals from the throughout other providers from the county for Native people who need mental health care. We've had very little limited mental health services available. And these are folks who really have been treated traditionally by the comprehensive community mental health system. The person who called yesterday needed 8 medications. They have schizophrenia and have just a list of things that they absolutely have to have. We, as you know, Paul's talking, we have the ability to bill for provider time to see them to do the consultation, but the medications for any one of these people are going to be $300 to $400 person a month. And as I described earlier, our pharmacy budget's $250,000. If you add the impact of this on our budget, I really don't know what we're going to do. And we are the safety net, and like Paul was saying, we can't refer them anywhere else because the buck sort of stops here. And these are individuals who, without their medications, are going to, you know, I was thinking that the hospital is a bad place, but you know, it's better than dying. And you know, what will happen to people in the streets, you just really don't know.
And better than jail and
right.
All the other. Okay, thank you. Paul, continue.
To carry along that same vein, the additional things that are kind of going on with our patient population, on the mental health side, to lose the medications, as Jackie just mentioned, is probably our biggest challenge right now. Again, we've been using pharmacy assists for years. I was starting to say that our HOPE program, which deals with real chronically mentally ill, where people are on 6 or 8 medications on average, they have spent hours and hours, and I know that they have succeeded at this point in getting at least 22 people out of about 30 that they've been pushing to apply for some level of medication. Now, 2 of those patients happen to be on my board of directors because, as a federally qualified health center, it was asked earlier, why don't all centers become federally qualified health centers? And one of the requirements is that 51% of my board of directors are consumers of services. 2 people who are my bosses essentially are homeless and mentally ill. And they were asked at a board meeting last evening, how's the pharmacy assist program, how are you going to be affected by things? One of my board members said, I'm lucky, the medication I'm on, I think I can get a full year free. My other board member said, I'm on 5 medications. To my knowledge, I've got 90 days of 2 of them, and we haven't heard on the other 3. And she's been a person who was in and out of the hospital. She's been hospitalized twice this past year. That's kind of representative, I think, of that population. On the medical side as well, it's always been a struggle to run a community clinic because physicians, at least down in this area, have always struggled with having specialists to refer to. 6 months ago, the conversation that we had every week was, you know, we're not primary care physicians anymore. We're not doing preventative medicine. We're not just doing obstetrics and new babies. We're not doing upper respiratory infections, ears and throats. We have become specialists. And in fact, some of the specialists in town have referred patients back to us and said, we can't do much more for you. You really need to see your primary care physician. And the translation of that is, you're costing us too much, and I'm not getting paid for this, so I'm going to refer you back to your primary care physician. I have lost 4 providers in the past 3 months. 3 of them, 1 is a nurse practitioner, and 2 are physician assistants. The primary reason given by the 2 physician assistants were, we're not trained to do this level of medicine. We are managing people with chronic illnesses, chronic pain, diabetes, on dialysis, on liver failure. We're not trained to do that, and therefore we cannot stay in this practice. We just feel like always our doctors support us, our MDs, but we're in over our heads. And that was our biggest concern 6 months ago, is how do you manage an aging and chronically ill population? without specialists. Now the conversation is, how do you expect us to stay and work when you've now taken away the one tool we had, or the few tools we had, which were the medications? Because we can manage some of those people, but now you're saying go visit the patients, do it in 15-minute increments because they're stacked up outside, tell them what their disease is, and now tell them here's a script for medication you can't have. So we've been trying to work for systems, quite frankly, to salvage our doctors, to save them. We have nurses and social workers lined up. We're changing their jobs, and their job, quite frankly, is to go in and listen to the patients after the doctor has skipped in and skipped out. Because the physicians have said, we're not staying in this environment. I have one who's going back to Canada in June. He said, I just don't need this. And basically they've said, doctoring is about making people well. We deal with illness, we make them well. We didn't get trained as social workers. We do a lot of that anyway, being a community health center. But now that our hands are tied, we can't do it anymore. It just isn't going to work to pay me to diagnose somebody and then say, but I can't treat you. My medical director yesterday said he got a call from a specialist who said, don't even bother to refer people to us with hepatitis C. The medication's $2,500 a month. Your patients can't afford it. I'm not even going to work them up. And that was reported at my medical staff meeting. My part-time internist said, you know, I have three people who are liver transplant patients, and their anti-rejection medications cost over $1,000 or $1,200 a month. They have no more medication as of March 1st. And she said, I don't know what to tell them. My board chair, who works at Salem Hospital, said we've had several patients that we have let go from our cardiac rehab program, because they're not going to be able to afford their heart medications. And people are sitting at home kind of saying, well, I guess this is sort of like death row for patients. We go home, and when we get sick, we'll die, or we'll try to end up in the emergency room.
Can we get away with hospitalizing you?
There are not, well, with, I'm sorry, which group would I hospitalize? I think that the difficulty is going to be the access to the service before you're critically ill, and when you're critically ill, are you going to be able to be salvaged? Because, again, what we're doing is managing people who are in good health and keeping them that way before they get
sick.
I mean
hospitalizing to get their meds.
You're
not going to get away with that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think, first of all, you're looking at, for Salem, a hospital which runs over 80, 85% capacity at all times. They don't have the beds or the ability to hospitalize to do that, nor do they have the medical staff to do it. On the mental health side, that's been part of the conversation, too, as well. When people get real sick, and my provider said, where are they going to go? And we said, well, let's see. We could send them to the county psychiatric crisis team, but then again, they're closing their night staff because they've lost all their emergency services monies, and they're thinking about closing down or downsizing even further. They can go to the emergency room, but the emergency room doctors are already railing, saying, don't send them to us. We're not psychiatrists. We're not specialists. And then I talked to a psychiatrist in town who said, doesn't matter anyway. In Salem, I have 18 beds. I already have 6 patients, he said, at this point, who are chronic that I can't discharge because they're back within 24 hours. One of them was our patient 2 weeks ago. She was the lady who was shot by the police with beanbags because she got out of the hospital and was not well, and she took it upon herself to take a knife and threaten police, and so they shot her with beanbags, and that's what she needed to do to get back in the hospital. So he said, that's, you know, hospital's really not an option. But they're going to be heading that way. And my own staff said, Paul, what do you expect us to do? My provider said, what do you want us to do? We feel responsible for these people. This is our population. We care about these people. We know them. We've known them for years. What do you want us to do? And I throw up my hand and say, I don't know what to do. One of the things we are doing is we're trying to figure out on the pharmacy side, how can we get the drug reps to give even more samples? We're trying to figure out and go through the stuff that we buy some medications as we can afford it through a program called Allscripts, which is one of the discount houses. We're trying to figure out if we can expand and change our formulary and buy even better generics, get more volume, and figure out if we can stretch that. But a lot of these patients we're talking about, both on the mental health side and the medical side, you're talking about bills of $1,200 to $2,500 a month for their medications. And it's not an option to say, well, you're on 5, why don't you take 2 and see how that works for you. So that's kind of the struggle. But what we've said is we're going to try to work to protect our providers and give them some relief so they don't leave, quite frankly, and the safety net system doesn't shut down. Secondarily, expand what we can on the pharmacy assist programs and stretch our budget as far as we can. I'm adding two full-time positions, one to pharmacy assist and one to social work, to which there is no money to support that. What we just flat out need to, or these people are totally going to fall through the cracks.
Anything more?
I think that pretty well gives you a flavor of at least how my day's been going. We could check in and see how yours is.
Yeah. Representative Greenlick, any further questions? Mr. Wacopian.
It seems to me somewhere I read or was seeing a graph of the number of FQHCs in different states, and I keep thinking Nebraska stood out as having quite a few more than Oregon. Is it how do some states, I guess, tend to have more clinics than others, and you mentioned this competitive process. Is it?
Yeah. If you go back into the history of setting up FQHCs in Oregon, when we had an 1115 waiver, which waived the cost-based reimbursement starting in 1994, that put our clinics at a financial disadvantage. Some other states had full cost reimbursement, and so they could afford to expand, and, you know, states like Colorado and others had some good reimbursement, and they took advantage of that expanding. We're in phase two of this expansion, and this is the biggest expansion that we've seen in history, really, of over the 5 years, doubling the number of patients, adding 1,200 clinics and 1,200 new communities. We're taking advantage of that. Like I said before, last year was the first year of it. 130 clinics were funded, new sites. We had six of those, so if you stretch that out across 50 states, we got more than our fair share, plus some even being a smaller state than other states. So we are trying to take advantage of it as best as we can because we're out from underneath that 1115 waiver and are trying to see if we can make ends meet to expand more in the future years as well. So we're doing everything we can to take advantage of it.
Yes, Paul.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I guess I would add one other comment, and that is just about safety nets in general. We have good federal support to be able to attract doctors to FQHC clinics. They have some scholarship programs and some loan repayment programs, which we take advantage of to attract new residents to the area. What's happening right now, since I'm down a couple of positions, have been recruiting heavily, we're looking at the class that's coming out of residency next June, and quite frankly, we're not attracting folks for a couple of different reasons, but the biggest one being they're looking at the state of the Medicaid population and the ability to make sure they get loan repayment and for really the solvency of the clinics in the long run, and people are choosing to go to our neighboring states. I mean, we've been a big draw. Oregon's a great draw for drawing new physicians, just cultural and all, but right now people are turning us down and they're going to Washington and Idaho.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Wacopian.
I don't know if it's both FQHCs and the rural health clinics. Does the state get additional money, like wraparound dollars, to do the cost reimbursement to these clinics? Does that impact, again, the amount of monies that are available?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about before. When we were under 1115 waiver, we didn't get full cost reimbursement, so we got what was less. Now we get full cost reimbursement under what's called a prospective payment system. And so the wraparound you're talking about is when a managed care organization pays us a rate for a visit, and it's lower than our cost or lower than our prospective payment system rate, then we get what's called wraparound from the state to make up the difference between the lower cost and what our true costs are. So it's still matched money. So 40% from the state, 60% from the federal government.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Logan and Ms. Mercer. If you have any written testimony that you'd like to send, seeing as we've had so many conflicts with members today, we'd certainly welcome that. And so, just please submit it, and we'll distribute it. And you know, and you two. Craig. Sorry. And do we have somebody from outside in today, or was
no,
that
no,
going
I'm
to be? They've been replaced by part of the by you folks. Okay. Well, I was sorry because I know Outside In is an excellent program in Portland, and I've heard very good things about NARA as well. And you're obviously you folks are serving those most in need in crisis, and it's getting worse. If you do decide to submit written testimony, please remember that we're sort of charged with rewriting the health plan as we have it and trying to salvage what we can. And any suggestions on how to make that system work better for you and how to work better for the state and for those most in need would be welcome and appreciated.
One thing I may add is, have you seen this book before? Okay, mm-hmm. It kind of gives just an overview that I think you're looking for if you want to flip back to it. We have extra copies here.
Oh, but please leave them for the members. That would be great.
Okay.
And we thank you for your testimony. And unless you have anything else to add, I think we're through for the day.
It's beginning to feel like Haydn's 102nd. You're going to be standing and playing the violin all alone in a minute.
Well, as long as Rome is burning, we may as well have some music, right?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Seeing no further business, committee, we'll adjourn.